So we were taking a look at essentially how things have moved quite so quickly. We've seen that part of the reason that morality seems to have been able to be turned upside down and be to have that happen so quickly, to have things that have always seemed right to all of a sudden become wrong, and things that were always deemed as wrong become automatically right, that it didn't happen just by accident, that there was an actual campaign at work to bring these things about with people who were just like-minded and had embraced some of the same values. And in particular, at the forefront in the last 3 decades, we have seen the what's generally known as the gay agenda. We have seen the push of homosexuality to be accepted, to be recognized, and to be normalized. And so that's been going on for, as I say, almost 3 decades. And it has been very careful in presenting the lifestyle before the general public to find a simple point or two that would be most palatable, most identifiable, to be able to present to the general public. Whether that was an accurate picture of life or not. For example, the picture that all we want is to be able to be married to the person that we love and care about, just like anyone else. When in reality, the statistics show that even 50% of the people who are allowed to be married and are in what they would call a permanent committed relationship remain involved in serial cheating or adultery, if you would call it that, for them, throughout their life. And many who pushed to have gay marriage recognized never married the partner that they were committed to. And so there's things that were dishonest, but they were presented in a way that would gain a tug on the hearts of the general population. Don't you want to be free to love the person that you love? Do you think someone else ought to be able to hinder you from doing that? And then to tie that in very carefully, psychologically and with the use of media, to tie that in to both education and to religion, but particularly to entertainment, so that these ideas are gradually accepted. And pretty much every comedy show now has at least one openly gay writer on them, and some of the most popular shows that are built around portraying single young women in sexual relations one after another outside of marriage is that which is the popular and ideal, and then married women who are cheating on their husbands as being very popular and ideal, gaining the ability to pull over the eyes of many married and single women and men the idea that this is just a norm, and quite honestly, that's all that this other part of the population wants themselves. And so why should we hinder that? So the three aspects that we saw last time that were being used to advance this would be a desensitization, a stage where we're just going to have this kind of material, and it has been for almost 40 years now, being presented in front of our face again and again and again, so that it's not the shock that it one time was. We become desensitized to this lifestyle. And then the next stage was a jamming, intentional creation of an emotional dissonance. I still find aspects that are repulsive, but emotionally I sympathize. That's the goal to get to. And then from there to conversion, to lead to the place where public opinion now no longer sees this as something that, well, I have sympathy for it, but I don't like this, I don't want this, to this is normal, just let it go. It should be fine. It should be part of life. It should be protected. And the recognition in that, because maybe you're sitting here saying like, well, we certainly didn't get to that place in my life because I'm not okay with this. You might be thinking that. Well, so does this movement, because they are certain that there are groups, pockets of people in the United States who are never going to be converted to say that this is okay. And those groups primarily are in the church. They are people who have a religious book that they adhere to. So they kind of equally, it's kind of, this is one of those places where things overlap. You know, Islam is no more friendly to homosexuality than Christianity is, but Islam has a sort of protected, persecuted status. So they're a little more gentle there. But as far as the bulk of the population in America, one of the key influencers next to the family is the church. And quite honestly, most people consider that were the church taken away, that you would see the family less and less an influence in that direction without that support. And so a top goal is to deal away with this group that will not be converted to say that all of these things are fine in our society. So this agenda is the point of the spear. This agenda is the point that is making its way in, then being jammed into society. And I've been there to hear leaders say to the others, to these other groups that would come after, we've spent all this time to make this acceptable. Once we're in, we'll make room for the rest of you. And so when we look there and we say, well, how did this happen so quickly? How do we go from just saying, well, you know, there are these people over here. They want to be in a committed marriage. They just want what everybody else wants. We're just going to allow them to have that marriage. How did that immediately turn into, I don't even know what to call you anymore when I check out from the cash register. I mean, what are you? Yes, Will. Sure. I was one of them. Yeah.
So that's good. But then many people, including Christians, will shout down to the Lord. They say, oh, you're enough to be crazy. That's never going to happen. And then go in the Lord and have
you. Okay. If you want to send me out for a mental health check, that's just let me know. But I think Glenda actually saw it in a post once when some of these other things happened. She's like, my pastor's been telling us this for years. So it's like, yeah, you know, right now it's prophecy has become reality. So this is what was happening along the way. We've seen that. Now understand that as it's going to continue to push forward, this entire host of others are going to become involved and going to be looking for acceptance in our society. Well, that's pretty much where we were leaving it off last week. I talked about the smoke and mirrors. I talked with you briefly about the way that psychology and advertising were used to bring this about in our society. So I want to move on and then just briefly talk about a few more items here. Let's talk about school and indoctrination. If I go back to the Frankfurt School back in the 30s, at the Frankfurt School, they said, quote, capturing people's minds and hearts through education is central to the strategy for a lasting social revolution. So there's really no secret agenda. This is not like, you know, some right-wing Christians got over here and we said, how are we going to describe this? No, this was their statement from the 30s. You know, if we're going to actually have something that's going to last, if we're going to have a revolution in society and that revolution is going to last and be stable, then we have to get a hold of the means of education. We have to begin to control education. And it's that long ago in the United States when we moved from reading, writing, and arithmetic, so to speak, over to using education as a way to socialize a population. Under Dewey and others, you go back and you would find that the dilemma that people were looking at was here in the United States, largely the population was made up of Western Europeans. And the immigration that was coming into the country were Eastern Europeans and other nationals that didn't share that same worldview, that same system of logic, those same ethics. And so they said, well, how do we help these groups coming in to be part of this melting pot, to become all, this one American, identity? And the school system was used for that purpose. Now, that's great. No longer is the school system really trying to do that. It seems more we're trying to make sure that we remain separate ingredients looking at the edge of the melting pot. So everybody's a hyphenated American of one kind or another. But more than that, it's just a small step from what Dewey was putting in to go a little step further and say, hey, guess what? We got this part down. Everybody can speak English. Okay, that's cool. Now, let's move on to what else do we want to socialize the students to think and to do? And so school becomes a tool for changing the cultural mindset of our nation and society. And it has been that demonstrably for many years. Probably many people look back, and if they've had an experience in public education, they were in public school, and they said, well, you know what? That wasn't so bad, because at that time, you probably believed most of the things you were being taught. Then you get out, and you turn around, you look at it and go, like, this is not the school that I went to, because the agenda continues to progress. Schools have been used for that purpose. You know, one of the things that it can always be concerning when you hear someone speak of your children and say, if I can get a hold of them for this period of time, then I will control their thinking for life. You know, the Roman Catholics famously said, if you give me a child for the first 6 years of their life, you know, I'll have them for the rest of their life. A lesbian activist essentially was saying the same thing. She said, Patricia Warren said, whoever captures the kids owns the future. It's an interesting thing to think that people are intentionally thinking about how to capture the minds of younger and younger people to promote these thoughts in this country. By the way, not new. Look, I'm not new. I've been around as a pastor here, one form or another, for a little while. This is my 30th year. So, no. It's more than that, I think. It's 40th year this year, yeah. Yeah, I look it, I know. So when I was first here at the church, working with the college and career group, we dealt with a movement at that time that came to Grand Island. It had been going through Western New York, it had gone through Hamburg and the Cheektowaga, and it had come here. And ostensibly, the pitch to the school board was, take our program and we will increase the graduation rate of your students. It was called EPIC, Effective Parenting Information for Children. It was a values clarification program. And if you're not sure what that means, as the teachers said, on the floor of the high school auditorium, because the school board meeting that we took a whole bunch of people to outgrew the little theater in the middle school. We filled up the auditorium. It was mostly people from college and career group here, some others from the church. We had some folks that had fought it out in Hamburg. And then I had a co-belligerent on abortion issues, a professor from Niagara University who was a specialist in natural law. So they got Christian worldview, they got natural law, etc. But we took a look at the program. And values clarification went like this, as one teacher said. Parents don't know how to teach values to their children. Professionals need to teach children their values. So whatever they're doing at home, we need an intentional program to teach children values, essentially ones you're not going to give them at home. We're going to tell them what's right, what's wrong, what's important, what's not important. And this was mid-80s here in Grand Island. Very, very early to mid-80s. And so we got in there, a whole bunch of folks from the church stood up. You know, the final thing I think that turned the day was both the number of residents in the auditorium, and that the big pitch that they could make was, we'll get your graduation rate up to like 91%. And the school board looked at each other and said, it's 93 now. You know, so that didn't help their pitch a lot. But the other thing is, they had tried to change their curriculum the night before they came in, because they knew they were going to get dinged on it. They had books for kindergarten students called Boys with Boys and Girls with Girls. They were taking these ideas down all the way through the entire school system in the mid to early 80s. And then later on, I heard the same thing when I was up with the Department of Education. This would have been later in the 80s. We were up with the Department of Education in Albany, sitting down with non-public school administrators, and they told us that they literally looked at us and said, you will teach this in your schools. And I said, if I teach that in my school, then I might as well close anyway, because we're no longer a Christian school. And they said, I said, so look, if what you're telling me is those few books that are in our library that the parents get, not us, and we put hold them in the library for them, if that's all you're upset about, you know, I'll put them on the sidewalk tomorrow. You can come pick them up. I'll tell you where you can pick them up. But we will not teach these things in our school. But this is not new. And this is intentional. And the intent has been going on probably as long as a few of you have been alive. I'll check birthdays later on the way out the door. But, this has been going on that long. And it's made its way back in, by the way. You know, they changed the name. What happened on Grand Island made the LA Times. It was startling. It shut it down here. But then it makes its way back. You know, it's like killing a weed in your lawn. You know, you do it once and then you think you're all done, and lo and behold, it's covering your lawn the next spring. It's made its way back in, just under different titles and different programs that didn't need school board approval. So, you know, it's here. And that's the approach that we see, using education to make this a solid part of the way that we think. And then, of course, I think in our daily life, most of us have become accustomed. Okay, that's not in good. I need we'll get to that one later. I think we have another challenge. This is me. So let's take a heading. You've got on your outline, if you got one, on prohibited speech. Let's think about prohibited speech. And so most of us, and I'll just put these two categories together, where it says certain words are to be punished and then certain ideas are to be banned. You know, the intention is to change the way that we speak. And we've all seen this going on, again, for decades. You call it political correctness. Started in the universities 2 weeks ago. Our governor just made it a law that, you know, utilities are now required to use whatever name and pronouns that you want when they communicate with you. Did you know you have that right now? You know, I mean, so if you want to, I'm going to hurry rush and take advantage of that. There was a college student when a college campus did that. He rushed right into the registrar's office and re-registered his name and pronouns. He said he was to be referred to by all professors in the future as Your Majesty. So I'm, you know, there's a new law. I think it's a great law. We should probably all, you know, look for that and, you know, pick your best ones and then tell Kathy that we'd like her to refer to us that way as well. I mean, that's just how that's the idiocy of where we're at. But that's gone from something in a liberal college campus to law in the state of New York already, and where she can control it. But where will it end? I mean, you've already been walking in as you've been doing your Christmas shopping and seeing people in Target or Walmart or other places, and on their name tag, they have their preferred pronoun. And then every once in a while, I mean, the first time I ran into that, I said, well, this could be helpful because, quite honestly, I couldn't tell, you know, without a label. But in most cases, no, I'm not planning to do that. Not planning to do that. That's the thrust. The thrust is we're going to cause the way that we treat speech to be done held differently or dealt with differently. For example, I always love this term, hate speech. Now, hate speech used to be something that was objective. I mean, there was certainly a history of certain words that have been used in terms of persecution, people who were going to try and, you know, do damage or harm to others. You know, hate speech is you blank, I'm going to kill you. Now it's just using a term that in the ear of the individual they find distressing. It comes into just in the workplaces, just trigger words. You know, just going, not going out of your way, just not guarding your speech. And I'm not even saying anything nasty about another gender. I've known employees from here that have gotten called into HR and told that, you know, you're creating a hostile work environment because you don't agree with what your employees are saying all around you all the time. You know, don't you believe this? Well no. That's a hostile work environment. And if you're going to continue to do that, you will lose your job. In this case, it happened to be some women that were accusing the person of creating a hostile work environment. Same company, a little bit later, the women got in trouble because the lesbians were going to be holding, you know, a wedding or a bridal shower. And one of the women, that was against her belief. She didn't want to attend. You know, how do you deal with that? If I don't go, then am I showing hate towards that individual? We want to change the way that we think, and part of that starts with changing the way that we speak. You know, you can, when you lose the vocabulary for things, then it becomes more difficult to think about them. And if we can forcefully remove vocabulary and go a step further and insist that you use different vocabulary that expresses something you don't believe in its place, then we can begin to make these changes something that will be permanent and abiding in our culture. Now we come to pooling efforts. Finally get to there, to the remaking of human identity. Well, you know, in that hideous strength, we started off looking at some of that. In that hideous strength, the work of people together in a group and using technology, they were looking to recreate mankind. And I would suggest to you that the same thing's happening today. There are people who are pooling their efforts. We've talked about some by name last week. And technology is a tremendous aid. Think about trying to change, dealing with hate speech, change the way people speak. If you say the wrong thing on, you know, we have basically ported most of communication to where? To media, to social media. I mean, how do people get information out? You know, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and probably 100 other things whose names I don't know and don't use. But anyways, you want to communicate now. I mean, that's how you do it. You know, pastors and churches and organizations used to write newsletters. Now they produce blogs. Go online, record it, send it out. What happens when those institutions, which are private, so you don't have any real rights in that area, are then pushed to censor speech? Government can't censor speech. Private institutions can. I mean, if you walk in here this morning and tell me that this morning you're planning to give the sermon and you're going to speak against the deity of Christ, I'm going to let you know that's not going to happen. In fact, I kind of do that even when people come and go, you know, the Lord laid this on my heart. I'd like to say this today. It's like, oh, no. No, not yet. So, think about how much people already have been censored in our society by the control of the media, whether that's the television programs, etc., or the instruments of communication that we find around us. Look, I really want to draw this to a close, and I might end up going a couple minutes overtime, so maybe they'll ring the bell in the back. We'll see. Peter Jones said this about a number of this cancel culture. He said, we are dealing with a neo-Marxism so committed to a classless egalitarian society that it must eradicate by any means possible embodied gender distinctions, which are the final bulwark of a creational difference written into our DNA. The goal is no longer a classless society, but a classless, mindless society. A classless, mindless, and genderless body, no longer just a fair deal for the worker, but a transformation of human psyche. At this point, such a powerful cosmology takes on an unmistakably religious character. Well, I want to draw this to a close. I'm not going to bother with what's up here. I want you to notice that this is the challenge that we're facing. And resisting this critical theory agenda. You know, I think there's some things you begin to see. You see some cracks in the veneer as one minority is fighting with another minority over who should be getting certain benefits. You know, the trans community and the feminist community arguing about who can participate in women's sports. Certainly, there are people, moderates on the left, who are coming out and screaming at their own people, saying, you know, you've just gone too far. Society is turning away. They're not going to support you. But I want to share a quote from a head of state. He was the head of, he was premier of Amsterdam, and also a reformed pastor. Abraham Kuyper said this: when principles that run against your deepest conviction begin to win the day, then battle is your calling, and peace has become sin. And you must, at the price of dearest peace, lay your convictions to bear before friend and enemy with all the fire of your faith. I'll close with a passage of Scripture, if you wouldn't mind listening. You know it. It's Psalm 2. We look at what's being amassed against in this world, but understand where our foundation and our support is. Why do the nations rage and people plot a vain thing? I think this is one of them. The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bonds in pieces and cast away their cords from us. He who sits in the heavens shall laugh. The Lord shall hold them in derision. Then he shall speak to them in his wrath and distress them in his deep displeasure. Yet I have set my king on my holy hill of Zion. I will declare the decree the Lord has said to me. You are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will give you the nations for your inheritance and the ends of the earth for your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron. You shall dash them to pieces like a potter's vessel. Now, therefore, be wise, O kings. Be instructed, you judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry, and you perish in the way, when his wrath is kindled but a little. Blessed are all those who put their trust in him. Let's close. Father, indeed, we thank you. We thank you even as we enter into this season when we celebrate the incarnation of your Son, that we have seen what the psalmists only heard of. We have seen the coming into this world of the mighty God, your Son, the Lord, who redeems us out of this corruption and who will continue to rule in this world, to put down all his and our enemies until the day when every knee will bow before you. So, Father, as we look about us and we consider the darkness of this world, may we turn our eyes to your throne and remember the coming of the light of your Son into this world and the ultimate victory that will be his. For we ask it in Christ's name. Amen.